This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. He's back tomorrow, but thank you so much for listening on this President's Day. So even though it's not a holiday for everybody, we know at least some of you are on a break today. And we're taking the opportunity to step back as well and take a look at how we in the media really cover the news and how you, the listener, consume it. We're going to take some time later this hour to consider what it is we do here on the radio and whether we're really explaining the news.
Well, I love the quirkier bits of public radio, when actually the editors are brave and will just take the listeners on a slightly kind of quirky journey. And suddenly you'll get, you know, half an hour about, you know, life in Namibia. It suddenly introduces an element of kind of thoughtfulness and peace in the schedules. I think it's the most courageous moments of public radio that are, you know, why it's a great thing. But I think it's at its worst when it's just, you know, a barrage of facts and data and changing the subject every 3 minutes. On that note, I know you're going to chuck me off.
The writer Alain de Botton, who we are not going to throw off, but we will hear from at length later in the hour. Also, as the second season of House of Cards plays out on devices all over the country, we'll see where fact and fiction part ways from the perspective of someone who has cracked the real-life majority whip. But we start in Geneva, and a damning report from the United Nations, which is drawing attention to what it calls unspeakable atrocities being suffered by those living in North Korea, and says the accused must face justice. The UN panel found evidence of torture, enslavement, sexual violence, and severe political repression and other crimes, and testimony included an account of a woman forced to drown her own baby. On the line from Geneva is the UN's Michael Kirby. He chaired this inquiry. Mr. Kirby, welcome.
Thank you.
We should note at the beginning that Pyongyang has denied this report. They say the evidence in the report is fake. Can you tell us about your sources and what information led you to make the stark conclusions that you make?
Well, the evidence was given to us by witnesses who were invited to come to the Commission of Inquiry. North Korea did not allow us to enter their territory, and therefore we had to have a very transparent process of receiving testimony from people outside North Korea. That wasn't difficult. There are 26,000 North Korean refugees in South Korea alone. Many of the witnesses would only give testimony under conditions of confidentiality, but about 80 gave evidence in public, and that evidence is online. It's on the internet. North Korea says that the witnesses are human scum and that their testimony is false. But we believe the witnesses, and we suggest that if ordinary citizens look at their testimony, they will come to a similar conclusion to ourselves. It was coherent. It was consistent. It was understated generally, and it was powerful, and it was courageous.
Many people think of North Korea and they just think repressive, this kind of blanket statement. But the amount of detail that you have here in this report, 120,000 political prisoners at least, an entire secret prison system. The state uses food as a mode of controlling the population, starving some and feeding others. You've painted a much more specific picture of what most people just think of as North Korean oppression here.
I think the power of this report is that it collects all the testimony together in the one document. We've known vaguely and generally. We've seen some things like the recent visit of Mr. Rodman, which make some people think, oh, well, this is a merry, funny little country. But in fact, it's not funny at all. And there are very serious, grave crimes that have been going on for a very long time, and they have to be responded to. And the object of the exercise was to give the United Nations the material upon which accountability could be made reality.
And since you've warned Kim Jong-un and others in the regime directly that they face possible responsibility as criminals against humanity, that they face justice in that way. Of course, Kim Jong-un is not going to give himself up to the extent that anybody in North Korea finds out about this. It'll be used as propaganda. So what now? Is anybody in a position to actually do anything about it? The world is not surprised that North Korea is a repressive place. What do you think is next in terms of the world response?
We went through in our report a number of options which are available to the international community. One of them is something that can certainly be done, and that is to create a structure, as we called it, some kind of special prosecutor or somebody within the office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights to continue to gather the type of testimony that we ourselves gathered. Many years ago, back in the 1990s, I was UN Special Representative for Human Rights in Cambodia. And in the case of Cambodia, just collecting the testimonies was a very important part of providing a basis on which Cambodia could proceed ultimately to the trial of some of the Khmer Rouge criminals, but also providing the source in history of the sufferings of so many people. Just recording the history has a value all in itself. But in terms of getting those who are accountable to a particular tribunal, the Commission of Inquiry suggested that that could either be done by way of establishing a special ad hoc United Nations tribunal, like the one in relation to the former Yugoslavia or Rwanda. But our hope is that China, when it sees the enormity of the human rights sufferings that are recorded in the report, will take the view that something has to be done. After all, China has to live next door to this country.
Evidence of enslavement and torture and a vast network of political prisons, just three items in a long list of atrocities in North Korea, all part of the Commission of Inquiry on Human Rights in North Korea from the UN. Michael Kirby is head of that inquiry. Well, over the weekend in Sochi, Olympians broke records and some of them broke down. Dutch speed skater Dorian Temoors broke the 1500 Olympic record by half a second. That's huge. American Bodie Miller, meanwhile, became the oldest alpine skier at 36 to win an Olympic medal. He tied for the bronze in the Super G yesterday. And in the women's Super G, 18 out of 49 skiers didn't even manage to finish the course. Lots of criticisms of the quality of the snow. With more of the highs and the lows at the Sochi Games is Mary Pallon, sports reporter for our partner, the New York Times, who I spoke to earlier.
So the results in speed skating have been really baffling. The Americans came into this Olympics with some real, you know, heavy hitters on their team who have done really, really well in the international circuit. Shani Davis is probably the name that most people are familiar with. You know, he has several Olympic medals anyway coming into this. And yet, as of yesterday, we were still empty-handed 0 for 21 or 24 medals. Meanwhile, the Dutch, you know, the women's 1500, they had spot 1, 2, 3, 4. And just a note on Moors of the Netherlands, she's a beast. I mean, she said she was historic anyway because she was the first woman to compete in both short and long track speed skating events at the Olympics, which is pretty unheard of. So not only is she competing in both of these sports, which are quite different from each other, but she's excelling. So, you know, there's been a lot of head scratching. What is it that they're doing that we're not? And I think it's going to take a long time to untangle it.
The Dutch have a long history of being good at speed skating, but you're right, like absolutely dominant this time around. Have they let on what they've been doing differently at all?
No, you know, one of their coaches who I was talking to said that, you know, there it's much more of a national sport. The Dutch Olympic team that's here, a lot of them compete against each other nationally in their own kind of commercial circuit. Speed skating in the U.S., although we, you know, historically it's been a strong medal generator, it doesn't get the ratings of, say, pro football. You know, it's just not
sure
as tied to our country's sports culture the same way. But I think what a lot of people are taking issue with is that that's not new. I mean, we still had Apollo Ono, we've had Bonnie Blairs, we've had these people, these rock stars, who did get to the podium before. So even the athletes, when I was talking to them yesterday and the day before, were kind of wondering, you know, was it individual to each person? Was it altitude training? Was it my breakfast cereal? I mean, there's just a lot of conversation about what all these factors were.
There's going to be a lot of figure skating and ice dancing, of course, in prime time between now and the end of the games. What are we looking for?
So tonight, Merrill Davis and Charlie White are going to take to the ice. They had a stellar night last night with the short program, and they're going for history as well. They might be the first American team to win a gold in ice dance. And what's funny about that is that historically, ice dance has kind of struggled as a sport, even within figure skating, to kind of be taken as seriously. And yet, even though the U.S. won the team medal, or won the bronze team medal, the Russians won the gold, they're our best shot at a gold figure skating medal, and they're on track to do so. They've won the national title, I believe, 6 times. They've just been killing it lately. So, you know, that's always entertaining to watch. The women's singles are coming up. Gracie Gold and Ashley Wagner are the Americans to watch there. Gracie Gold looked great at nationals in Boston. There's a lot of excitement. So, figure skating, it's, you know, it's always very political. I always love all the gossip behind the judging and the decisions. And so we'll see. There's already a lot of that brewing.
Mary Pilon is sports reporter for our partner, The New York Times. You know, Mary, you can't watch the coverage in primetime here without seeing how much the networks rely on image and personality and sort of the backstories of all the athletes. Nobody is just somebody who worked hard and won a medal. They all have a, you know, sort of a lachrymose story behind it. And I guess that's part of what television is all about these days. You know, you're in Russia, and it makes me wonder if, like, Russian television treats its star athletes the same way, or do they all have like these long sort of stories on their own coverage that leads to endorsement deals later? Does anybody do it like we do it?
You know, I think the American media is a unique beast. I think the Russian media is a unique beast. But what I do know that, especially with figure skating, with the pairs and the team event, when there's an event with Russian athletes in it here, it's the atmosphere is pretty electric, especially for sports that they've really excelled in. I was actually in curling this afternoon, and the Russian curling team isn't even the top ranked right now. But whenever they play, or have a really good, you know, hit with the rock. And again, this is curling. Like, it's not something that is used to getting as much attention as figure skating. People were going crazy. They had air horns, they had flags, they had... So, you know, I don't know if the media does as much storytelling, but something's getting through in terms of who these stars are. And in figure skating, it's kind of a unique winter sport because there are no helmets. You do see people's faces. They go in the kiss and cry booth, which is this, like, very strange tradition where you see people, you know, their entire lives for the last 4 years on edge there. So it's much more emotional. The connection and the fact that they have so many dynamic skaters at this Olympics, especially after they were, you know, pretty disappointed in the results in Vancouver, I think has really connected with people, Russians who are here in Sochi, but also people who are probably watching in, you know, Moscow, St. Petersburg, or elsewhere.
Well, I don't know what Russian Wheaties would taste like or even what they're called, but Mary Pilon, you might be the first American to bring home a box with a Russian curler on the front of it. It's Mary Pilon, sports reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, on that note of demanding big personalities from our Olympic athletes, that media strategy backfired for NBC last night. A lot of viewers, including this one, thought reporter Kristen Cooper relentlessly pushed Bodie Miller to tears, asking about his dead brother over and over and over, and then filmed the aftermath of him crying on camera. Well, NBC released a statement defending the interview. They say our intent was to convey the emotion that Bodie Miller was feeling after winning his bronze medal, said NBC Sports. We understand how some viewers thought the line of questioning went too far, but it was our judgment that his answers were a necessary part of the story. We're gratified that Bodie Miller has been publicly supportive of Kristen Cooper. Bodie Miller indeed did defend Cooper this morning in an interview with Matt Lauer. Well, up next, we enter the no-tier zone, I promise. We're talking all performance. It's the biathlon. That's coming up.
The only thing I want to experience is winning a gold medal.
Sitting on the slopes of potential history.
We hit up to 6G forces.
Well, the one thing you can count on is absolutely nothing.
If you can't race yourself, you can't race anybody else.
An all-out fight to the finish.
There's no such thing as can't.
Pushing it till the end, and he's got another gold medal.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you. Let's go back to Sochi for a minute. Do you know the name Ole Einar Bjørndalen? Would you know who he is if his name came up in a trivia contest? He tied the record last week for the most medals in Winter Olympic history. Now, at 40 years old, Bjørndalen is the oldest individual event winner in history also, and his sport is the biathlon. And it makes some sense because Norway invented the biathlon. Now, I get into fights all the time with friends, with anyone who'll listen, really, because I say that biathlon, a sport unseen by Americans except every 4 years, is the hardest sport in the world. Of course, the biathlon grew out of military training and hunting. You ski hard through mixed terrain, stop every few kilometers, pull a rifle off your back, and with your heart pounding, hit 5 targets the size of golf balls at around 60 yards in a crosswind. If you miss, killer penalty, all while your entire country watches every shot. And hey, biathlon is the only winter sport where the United States has never gotten a medal. So let's put my theory to the test as part of our Olympic series, How Do They Do That? Eric Goff is back with us. He's our resident Olympics physicist. He's chair of the physics department at Lynchburg College and author of Gold Medal Physics, The Science of Sports.
Well, the biathlon is a great winter Olympic sport. And these targets, when you're prone, are only less than 2 inches, maybe 1.8 inch in diameter. If you're standing, it's about 4.5 inches in diameter. So every time you take a breath, every time your heart's pounding and you feel your hands moving a little bit, you can't shake more than 26/1,000ths of a degree if you're lying down, or if you're standing, about 89/1,000ths of a degree. You can't shake that gun more than that. Now, when you're in the prone position shooting in the biathlon, you've only got about 26/1,000ths of a degree either way that you can miss. If you're standing, it's a little bit more giving. It's about 89/1,000ths of a degree, plus or minus either side of your target. So the room for error is essentially nil. You have to make your shot. And if you don't, the great thing about the biathlon is they penalize you. You have to do laps. It's an amazing, amazing event.
Well, let's forget about all the straight physics for 1 second here and maybe talk about physiology, medicine, straight athletic prowess. The biathlon is an event that a lot of people have been watching at the Olympics, and it's an event that really isn't on the radar of a lot of Americans, but it's my theory. I'm here to tell you that the biathlon is the hardest sport in the world. That's my theory. Kurt Schreiner, what do you think of my theory?
I like your theory. After doing it for 25, 30 years of my life, I can kind of tend to agree with you on that one.
Now, let's tell people, Kurt Schreiner, you are a three-time Olympian and director of the Saratoga Biathlon Club, three-time Olympian biathlete yourself, right?
Yes.
Your heart rate, when you're cross-country skiing, what most people would think of as the Nordic track, that aerobic exercise, on the world-class level, how high is your heart rate?
Basically, when you're racing at that level, the guys that you're watching on TV, their heart rate when they're coming into the range is probably between 175 and 190.
Yeah, so that's peak performance for really any human, isn't it?
Basically.
180, okay. We can watch great marathoners, great cross-country skiers on television or at the Olympics and say, wow, what an athlete. Biathlon adds this element. You come into the shooting range, take the gun off your back, and at 180 heart rate, start to hit a target the size of a golf ball from about 50 meters or 50 yards. Can you help me begin to understand just how you do that?
Well, first of all, it takes an awful lot of practice, years and years of it, to get really good at it. And basically what you're doing is you're teaching yourself to shoot with a high heart rate and shaking limbs and heavy breathing. And basically, a lot of people think that you're lowering your heart rate. I mean, yeah, and to some extent, you are a little bit. But these guys who are doing this, especially nowadays, are in such good shape that when you stop skiing, your heart rate automatically starts to lower. So you're at 180 when you hit the range. But by the time you set up 15 seconds later, some of these better guys are probably in the 160s or, somewhere around there.
Oh, just 160. So at that point, it should be easy to hold a gun steady and hit a target.
It's not easy at 160 either, but doing it thousands of times, basically, and learning how to do it. And that's kind of what biathletes do.
So when you talk about being able to combine the high heart rate of the skiing with the serenity you need for good shooting, what does it take to learn that? Of course, we talked about physical conditioning and being able to lower your heart rate, sure. What does it take in terms of practice, not only to be a good shot, but to be a good shot under such physically demanding conditions?
Well, basically, it takes going out and shooting 4 or 5 days every week throughout the training year and learning how to shoot with a high heart rate, not to mention, doing a lot of slow fire shooting, too. There's so much to shooting that we don't even really have time to touch on all of it, but I can tell you wind is a factor with shooting a .22 caliber bullet. Light is a factor. Humidity is a factor. And you have to learn how to deal with all these. And you're not seeing it when you're watching these guys race on TV, but that when they come to the range, they're not only just getting ready to shoot, they're looking at the wind flags and they're making mental adjustments on how they have to adjust their sights.
And then there's also the mental game here. We've kind of touched on the physical. You know, in preparation for this, I was reading some studies from sports medicine, and I read one on choking, sort of the sports phenomenon of the choke, the last second sort of miss that loses the race. And it wasn't the free throw NCAA basketball or the last second field goal that they studied. It was the biathlon shot as the psychological paradigm of the choke. I mean, if you're in the last shooting round of a 30 kilometer race and you have to hit 5 shots out of 5, that's choke worthy, boy.
Oh, without a doubt. And I've had my share of chokes over the years. I mean, basically, you hit 9 out of 10 and then you miss the last shot, or you hit 19 out of 20 and you miss the last shot. And you can see it when you watch the Olympics. The guys who are doing their last stage in any race, and sometimes they'll miss their last shot. It's choking, basically.
Kurt Schreiner, I don't even care if you don't think it's the hardest. I still do. But I'm glad you joined us to talk about your sport.
Yeah,
thank you so much.
I love the sport. And thank you very much, Todd, for including me in this.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals monitor and manage online reviews, now offering a review kiosk to help customers create reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com.
Well, today, of course, is President's Day. I hope you have the day off. And indeed, that's what President's Day is to a lot of people, right? A day to not work. But it's also, hey, a day to remember and honor our leaders, even if that term, president, the actual word, was once meant to be anything but honorable. In fact, before 1787, when the Constitution was ratified, the term president had never before referred to a head of state. So how did George Washington and other founders settle on president as opposed to, say, chief magistrate, emperor, prime minister, potentate? Well, joining us is Mark Forsyth, author of the Etymologicon and Horologicon, who blogs at inkyfool.com. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the show.
Good to have you. This term president these days sounds like somebody who's powerful and flies on Air Force One and gets all the respect, but it wasn't always so.
No, the whole idea of president is it's meant to sound really humble. It's meant to be an absolutely nothing title. Because when the United States was just setting itself up and trying to work out its constitution, its titles, there was the question of what to call George Washington. And one of the big things that people worried about was that George Washington might become a dictator himself. He'd just thrown off George III, and now there was this guy with all this power, General Washington. And so they needed to bring him back down to earth, or that was the feeling in the House of Representatives. So they didn't want to give him a grand title. And there were a lot of possibilities for what they might call him emperor or king was even on the table. His Highness George Washington. But they wanted to make sure he didn't get drunk on power, he didn't get carried away. And so they gave him the most pathetic title they could think of. And that title was president, which at the time meant almost nothing. It was little more than being like foreman or overseer or manager of the country. Indeed, president was the standard term for somebody who ran a company in North America at the time.
Or who runs a meeting. I mean, president is just the person who says, okay, everybody sit down and let's start the meeting. I mean, really boring.
Yeah, it's just what it is, just the guy who presides over a meeting. Yeah, that's all president was. And in fact, there was an awful lot of argument about it at the time because, as I say, the House of Representatives, they really wanted to keep George Washington down and not give him any sort of grandiose title like King or Emperor or Your Highness. But the Senate really wanted to give him a good title because they said this guy has to go and negotiate with other nations. He has to be impressive. And America will be a laughingstock if our head of state has a pathetic little title like President of the United States of America. So the Senate really wanted to have King or Highness or something along those lines just so he could meet foreign dictators, foreign kings, monarchs on an equal basis.
And of course, over the years and generations since then, it's sort of easy to see how the term president has changed in our minds because of the power of the office. And I wonder if the term president and our perception of the word has sort of ebbed and flowed with the power of the presidency. Look, the presidency is not today what it was when George Washington was president. We've always had fights about how powerful the president really is. Has the word gotten more and less powerful at the same time?
The word has gotten so much more powerful, it's unbelievable. Because the thing is, politicians are always trying to change reality by using particular words, using language, you know, with, you know, do you call them freedom fighters or terrorists or that sort of thing. But the President of the United States is and has been for at least 50 years the most powerful man in the world. I mean, he has over 5,000 nuclear warheads at his disposal, a fleet of drones, the largest economy in the world, and all that sort of stuff. So, of course, President of the United States, which was picked as this title to keep him down, is now the most impressive sounding title on earth. But now, I think it's about 150 countries have presidents, because everyone who's a head of state now wants to sound like they're as powerful as the President of the United States of America.
It's a good brand now.
Yeah, it's a great brand.
Mark Forsyth is author of The Etymologicon and Horologicon. He blogs at inkyfool.com with a history of the word we take for granted, president. Mark, thank you.
Thank you very much indeed.
Well, early on Friday morning, Netflix released the entirety of season 2 of House of Cards, and fans went nuts. Now, Netflix won't release the viewership numbers, but based on all the hype online and the fan campaign to get the series released early, estimates by one internet provider that 15% of Netflix subscribers watched it over the weekend. It's safe to say that House of Cards is a huge hit. Now, everyone who watches the show loves Kevin Spacey as the ruthless Washington insider Frank Underwood. He plays the majority whip. And lots of politicians around Congress, I can tell you, watch the show as well. There are a lot of fans who are real politicians. The question is just how realistic is the show about a corrupt majority whip? Well, we have a real majority whip to join us to share his insights. Congressman David Bonnier, former majority whip of Michigan, is here. Hi, Congressman.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
Well, it's great to have you. Let's start off at the top. Listen to this clip of Frank Underwood describing his job, and I want to see how realistic this is.
For those of us climbing to the top of the food chain, there can be no mercy. There is but one rule: hunt or be hunted.
Years ago, Congressman Bonnier, I covered you when you were whip, and I always thought that hunt or be hunted was kind of your style.
Well, no.
Of course. I'm kidding.
It certainly wasn't. And the portrayal of Frank Underwood, masterfully done, I think, by Kevin Spacey, is a very dark character. And there's no redeeming value to him, nor for that matter, much of any of the characters in the show. But he does have a way of manipulating, and he has a sense of strategy, and he has the smarts and the confidence to take the viewer into the world of politics and make it somewhat believable, although I think his portrayal is much too dark. I mean, I don't know of any whip, for instance, that's ever committed murder.
No, of course not. But you do know whips who need to get a bill passed when it's tough. And, you know, the manipulation that Frank Underwood undertakes, the ruthless kind of undermining of people, does it ever really take that to pass a bill, or is passing a bill a lot more boring?
No, it's not boring to pass a bill, because you're dealing, if you're a whip in either party, you've got to corral your caucus and conference members, and you got to provide the votes to get things done, to move the legislation, to make Congress relevant to people's lives. And so you use different techniques to get that done. I think this show is overly dramatic and pessimistic and dark in the portrayal of how that's done.
What was your favorite tactic? Incentives? We can do something for you if you vote with us? Or threats? We'll do something you really don't like, or we'll sort of politically break your arm if you don't.
Threats don't generally work. I mean, rewarding people for being good soldiers in the fight to get things that you care about done works much better. For instance, committee slots, making sure that their offices are accessible and convenient. Things of that nature help, helping them politically in their races back home, helping them raise money. Those kinds of things obviously go on. They go on in legislatures. They go on in the U.S. Congress.
Everybody says these days, now that earmarks have been banned from Congress, that that's part of the reason why John Boehner and the real-life majority whip Kevin McCarthy have such a hard time with Republicans. They can't offer them pork.
There's some truth to that. I think helping someone get a project for his or her district that means something to them in terms of jobs, in terms of economic development is often a very helpful way to ingratiate yourself and get them on the team and to get their support for things. And I was never really a person who felt that negatively towards earmarks. I think for the most part they generally were used well and provided services and jobs and opportunities and sometimes social justice concerns and issues that help people. But there obviously were abuses, and those abuses were magnified in the public, and those abuses helped kill earmarks. And so it has become more difficult, I think, as a result of that.
Well, David Bonnier was the majority whip. He's a Democrat. He was a majority whip in the 102nd and 103rd Congress. He's from Michigan and helped us unpack the ruthless Frank Underwood star of House of Cards. Congressman, thank you.
You're welcome.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
You know, Jimmy Carter has become known since the 70s for a couple of things. You probably know what they are. How about long gas lines, the Iran hostage crisis, maybe that M word, malaise? But did you know that Jimmy Carter's encounter with an angry swamp rabbit in the spring of 1979 lasted only a second, but it played a key role in derailing his hopes for a second term? It's true. It changed the way American presidents have managed their image since then. Now, if you don't believe me, let's go back to 1976, and the story begins there, when Jimmy Carter is an unknown on the national stage. But he has a compelling resume.
He's a peanut farmer, a Baptist deacon, an 11-year Navy veteran, and a nuclear engineer.
Carter beats Gerald Ford in 1976, but he gets to the White House and finds a country in turmoil.
Some 60 Americans, including our fellow citizen whom you just saw bound and blindfolded, are now beginning their sixth day of captivity inside the U.S. Embassy in Tehran.
WNYC reporter Jim O'Grady says that all that turmoil set the stage for a silly story that blew up into what we'd now call a meme and did serious damage to Carter's presidency and his legacy. Jim O'Grady joins me now. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Todd.
I mentioned at the top of this a killer rabbit attack. Can you please explain what I'm talking about?
So it's the spring of 1979. As you say, there's all this turmoil going on in the country, in the White House. So President Carter goes back to his hometown in Plains, Georgia for a vacation. And he gets in a little fishing boat and he goes out on a pond and he hears something from behind, some disturbing noise. He turns around and I'll let AP reporter Brooks Jackson describe what happens next.
It was hissing, tried to get in the boat, and he had to fend it off with an oar. He had been approached by a swimming rabbit, a big one, he said, a killer rabbit.
A rabid rabbit coming at the boat?
Well, it's down in Georgia, they call them swamp rabbits, and they swim and they get agitated. So it was approaching the boat. And Brooks Jackson said, okay, it's August when he hears about it. He writes the story because it's a slow news day. He knows he's learned that he can write a long piece about the Social Security system, but the piece that people will read and talk about is a story about animals. So he writes it up, and the thing, it just goes viral. There are these editorials written about it, cartoons in the paper, and check this out. There's novelty songs, including this one.
President Carter got into his boat, wasn't in a hurry, wanted to float. Think about the country, think about sin. Along swam a rabbit and he tried to climb in. And what did Jimmy say? I don't want a bunny wunny in my widow old boat. In my widow old boat in the pond. For the bunny,
it blows up. And I asked Kevin Mattson, he's the historian we heard earlier, why this story went so big.
I think in many ways the story of the killer rabbit incident only makes sense when you understand what else was going on during the summer of 1979.
All right. What was going on in the summer of 1979, he says. What's he referring to?
So all those crises we described before. And also you have to remember that Jimmy Carter ran for president with a slogan. After Vietnam and after Watergate, his slogan was, I will never lie to you. And you can hear it in this campaign commercial.
I'll never tell a lie. I'll never make a misleading statement.
So don't tell me that Jimmy Carter took that so seriously that he put this killer rabbit story out himself.
That's exactly what happened. He
oops.
Because when the story first came out, people didn't believe it. They said, really? No, that doesn't make sense. Rabbits don't swim. And this wounds Carter because his reputation for honesty is all important to him. So he makes the White House photographer go back to the darkroom, fish out a photo of the rabbit swimming away after Carter has splashed it with his paddle, blow it up, and release it to the press. And that's when the story just takes off.
This is a good time to tell people that you can look at the killer rabbit photo that Jim O'Grady refers to on thetakeaway.org. So the songs get written, the papers go with it, it gets out there. Does this contribute to the, like, a wimp image that we have today? I mean, you know, like a greater man, a Ronald Reagan, wouldn't get attacked by a little tiny cute rabbit? Is that
exactly
the idea?
It's not fair, but it's politics, which is driven very often by symbolism. It crystallizes this idea that he's not exactly in control of events. This guy who's supposed to protect us from nuclear attack by the Soviet Union lets a rabbit get the drop on him when he's out fishing. So what Carter does is he hires an advertising man from Wall Street called Gerald Rafshoon to head up something called the White House Image Repair Team. We take this for granted today, this kind of like image operation.
Ongoing today. There's no repair team. It's ongoing now.
It's institutionalized.
Yeah.
But back then, this was a very unusual thing, and Carter was criticized that, like, why can't you just speak to the people? Why do you need a Svengali managing your image? And it's at this moment that the Reagan campaign team looks at the killer rabbit story and they think two things. A, Carter is beatable. And B, when we get in the White House, we are never going to let that happen to us. And it's the Reagan White House that installs this machinery that we have to this day with photo ops and image management. I think Obama has something like three people to manage his Twitter feed. This is the modern press office of the American presidency. It comes out of fear of the killer rabbit.
Jim O'Grady is here to say that you can attribute the modern managed image of the president of the United States, not to television, not to the internet, but to one angry killer swamp rabbit.
That's right, Todd. We tried to get an interview with a rabbit, but he was unavailable.
Jim O'Grady, thank you.
You're welcome.
If you want to hear Jim O'Grady's complete reporting on this story, head over to WNYC.org. You can also find his full interview with I Don't Want a Bunny Wunny songwriter Tom Paxton, and to see those photos of the attack, just go to the website, thetakeaway.org.
President Carter saved the day, splashed with a paddle, rabbit swam away. Jimmy was a hero, felt it in his bones, said in the words of John Paul Jones.
Now imagine if the 24-hour news cycle had been around in 1979 when that swamp bunny attacked Jimmy Carter. It would have been a way different story. Well, coming up, we're talking with Alain de Botton about the pros and cons of that never-ending news cycle. What do you think? Does the 24-hour news cycle turn you off?
Hi, this is Michael from Seattle. I don't think it's the 24-hour news cycle that's the problem, although they do create news where none is. I think it's the people that watch the 24-hour news. We should know better than to sit around watching the news all day and getting worked up about nothing.
Michael says, just turn it off. What do you think? Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE. There's much more at thetakeaway.org.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention. Dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you, filling in for John Hockenberry. You know, everywhere we go nowadays, the media follows. Technology really has transformed the way we understand how we consume the news. Just 10 years ago, most of us read the morning paper or tuned into the evening news, one of the three major broadcast networks. Now, the growth of cable and the internet has totally disrupted those habits. According to the Pew Research Center, since 1980, the three major nightly newscasts, that's ABC, NBC, and CBS, of course, have lost about 28 million viewers. That's more than half their audience. And of course, the news we consume today, not only on the internet, follows us around on our iPhones and our mobile devices. Well, as that news audience splinters, our next guest worries that we're not getting the whole picture, really, that the news more than ever has become segmented, narrow, with stories that are mosaic tiles of a larger truth that the news misses, everything from restaurant reviews to political reporting, even to photos, just little pieces of a picture that we're not really seeing. Joining me now is Alain de Botton, author of The News, A User's Manual. Alain, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Wonderful to have you. You know, you say at the beginning of your book that news in modern society has largely or is largely replacing religion. And I noticed indeed that your book reads almost like a philosophical religious manual, something a series of missives that the Dalai Lama might have passed down to his followers. And I don't mean to elevate you that much. You're probably not comfortable with it. But those two things seemed similar to me.
Well, look, you know, religion, we used to go to religion in order to find out, you know, right from wrong, the meaning of life. The most consequential and important issues would be raised in a religious context. Nowadays, in the more secular parts of the United States, that just isn't true. People turn to this other great dominant force in society, and that is the news.
You give the example, a couple of examples. You give the example of man requests lawyer, which is not an exciting scene, but if you draw back and then back and then back, you might be reading Anna Karenina. You give the example of a painting where if you're standing just 3 centimeters from the painting, it looks like not much. And if you step back and back to a meter or two, you're looking at the Last Supper, something great and full of context. What can the news do to achieve that kind of broader scope that you're talking about?
You know, the news needs us to keep coming back. And one of the ways in which it does that is that it keeps telling us that the update on the update of the update is the most crucial thing about a story. And of course, most stories running through our society cannot keep up with the news cycle. And in other words, we're constantly given headlines, apparently huge turning points of stories that are actually 20 years long, or you know, at least 1 year long, but not every 5 minutes. And yet we are catapulted from fear to hope to a catastrophic sense of foreboding by the machine that needs us to be alert and constantly poised to receive some, you know, absolutely cataclysmic revelation. And the world reality is not quite like that. So the result is that a lot of the news doesn't quite know where to go in our minds. And the clearest evidence of that is that if you say to most people, what was in the news last week, they won't be able to tell you. So this amazing source of information that was meant to change everything and make the world clear is oddly in danger of confusing us and leaving us slightly, well, for want of a better word, numb.
There is a great deal of, I'll call it advice for those of us who are in the news business, those of us who report on politics or even, as I mentioned, restaurant reviews or even photographers or photo editors. But what about the news consumer? You know, if so much of the news is reported in a segmented mosaic fashion, and I'm guilty of this as I read your book, I realized that I certainly am. What can the listener, the reader, the person on the end do for more context if the mosaic pieces they get keep coming? And of course, they don't want to be in the dark. They want to keep reading the news and understanding the world.
Look, I think, you know, a very basic insight that all news users need to have, we call it the news, but of course, it's not the news. It's some news rather arbitrarily fished out of the billions of stories that humanity produces every year and packaged for you in a very particular way. And that's just something always bear in mind. It is not the whole story. No news organization, though each news organization wants to claim this, no news organization can give you reality. Reality is multifaceted. And so we need to keep our eyes and ears open and also know, of course, when to switch off. I mean, the news Sabbath is something as a concept which would have sounded totally bizarre even 5 years ago. But now more and more people are going, I can't take this any longer. There's a limit to how much of this information I can collect and use.
One of the observations that you make also in the beginning of your book really struck me as a political reporter. You said that so much of the news in the end becomes the vague and unsurprising sediment of conclusions. And that really is what political reporting is all about. The example being very few people remember a lot of facts about a politician or an event, but they remember an overall picture. Mitt Romney is a greedy, rapacious, bad person. Barack Obama is an untrustworthy foreigner. These vague impressions that the little stories that I've reported 40 or 50 times don't matter anymore.
That's right. I mean, it tends to settle. All the little bits of information that we get settle into very broad kind of stories, because that's the way our minds work. Our minds have to sift information and chuck out the stuff that, you know, isn't relevant. You know, news editors and journalists tend to be very nervous people. They're all the time afraid of losing their audience. And they think the best way to not lose the audience is to throw a lot of stuff at them and see what sticks and keep the conversation turning. I mean, for example, you know, we're talking here for, you know, 7 minutes, maybe 6.5 minutes, right? And the feeling is, okay, what happens if this guy with a strange name from England kind of bores everybody? We've got to get him off the air, and we'll get to the better bit, and, you know, and maybe that will be bad too. So we'll do 4.5 minutes on something else, and then 3.5 minutes on something else. And, you know, the result is that after a few hours of listening to this stuff, you're just thinking, I am overwhelmed.
No, we're not overwhelmed. We're not bored at all, Alan de Botton, but our 7 minutes are up, and we're nearing the end of the show, so we have to let you go and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Alain de Botton is author of The News, A User's Manual. Well, we here at The Takeaway are going to take a hint from Mr. de Botton and wrap it up. We don't want you to take us for granted, after all, like the rest of the 24-hour news cycle. From Little Rock, Arkansas, accurate fast news is infinitely better than slow news. One of the major concerns of the 24-hour news cycle is the sacrificed accuracy.
My name is Robert Davis. I'm calling from New York City. I just wanted to say there is no such thing as too much information. However, misinformation can be used to manipulate the minds of the masses. So therefore, we must be ever vigilant and keep our filters in place so that we know what to take in and what to leave out.
Thanks to you, Robert, from Brooklyn, New York. It's nice to be informed. However, we don't need to be inundated. I feel like the 24-hour news cycle increases my anxiety. Also, I've noticed the younger generation feels the need for instant gratification. It's overkill. And David from North Miami, Florida, writes to us, the 24-hour news cycle is a distraction. Failure to fund NPR and PBS to match the BBC conspires with laziness by few networks. Oh, aren't we self-serving for putting that in? David, I don't disagree with you, actually. Give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can send us your tweets at The Takeaway, and be sure to check us out on our website at thetakeaway.org. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Don't worry, he's back tomorrow. And this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.